How are we supposed to make sense of Bitcoin's place in a long-term financial plan or determine its position in our overall portfolio? Part of the challenge in Bitcoin financial planning today is how old Bitcoin is as an asset, but also in finding people who will give you good advice about how to do it and how to think about it. Jim Kreider is a Bitcoin-focused financial advisor from Texas, and he's joining us today for a conversation about his insights in helping people think about Bitcoin as part of a long-term financial strategy. I'm Scott Dietels. I'm the CEO and founder of Block Rewards, and part of our mission in bringing Bitcoin to the workplace is helping people understand how it will help them. So if you're interested to learn something about one person's view on Bitcoin as a long-term bedrock of a financial plan, stick around. This one was very informative. All right. Welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast. We are joined this week by Jim Kreider from Intentional Living Financial Planning in Texas. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Scott. Appreciate you having me.
We are going to maybe spend a little bit of time today talking about some of the work you're doing, helping people understand Bitcoin and incorporate it into long-term planning. And maybe before we do that, give us a little bit of an introduction about yourself and how Bitcoin came to be a part of your practice at your personal practice.
Yeah. Well, about myself, as you mentioned, I live in Texas. I've got four young kids. So I spend most of my time chasing them around and hanging out with a wife. I own a financial planning company. We've served clients across the nation. So yeah, basically spend 9 to 4 every day answering people's money questions and talking through vision for life and what's important to people and how do we align their money with those things. Bitcoin's funny. It plays in a sense a large role in financial planning for us, but at the same time, it plays just another role as any other part of financial planning. So I don't view it like Bitcoin is not a financial plan, but it is part of one, in my opinion. So, you know, like tax planning is not financial planning, but my goodness, if you're going to have a good financial plan, you better have good tax planning. And same thing with Bitcoin. If it's Bitcoin itself, and I hear that all the time. People say that on Twitter and stuff, like, oh, my financial plan is Bitcoin. It's like, dude, like, I don't care what aspect it is, how great of an asset you own, that is not a plan. So anyways, yeah, we talked through Bitcoin a lot. How I came to that, I first heard about Bitcoin 12 years ago and dismissed it quickly. I think like almost everyone I've ever talked with, write it off at first exposure. And then started getting a little bit more curious late 2015, early 2016, but didn't really fall down the rabbit hole until I was forced to in early 2020 with the shutdowns and the thought of more in your face. Everything is way more centralized than you thought. So March of 20 very quickly went down the rabbit hole of what are actual hard assets? What is money in reality? Like what's been the history of money? And what's something we can trust moving forward? And basically came to the conclusion at that point, I either need to further understand and utilize gold, real estate, or Bitcoin. And after looking in that for a while, I came to the conclusion that Bitcoin would be the anchor of those three assets. So yeah, since at that point, that was early 20. And I basically went all in for my family. But I was at another financial planning office where I couldn't talk through those things with clients. Early 21, separated from there, started my own firm. And from day one, Bitcoin has been integrated to all of our clients' financial plans.
It's amazing how many people had that revelation or experience in 2020 as like just a major wake-up call. Really, not even so much about Bitcoin, but just in terms of paying attention to the monetary system and like sort of pulling back the curtain around some of the aspects of it that we were mostly able to ignore over all of our lifetimes prior to that slowdown. So as you're sitting down with a new client and they are trying to figure out, you know, maybe they've come to you because they're Bitcoin curious, how do you sort of set the table around what role Bitcoin might play as part of a larger plan?
So I have to come at this from two different directions. So in the situation you pose, they come to me because they're Bitcoin curious, or maybe they're already a Bitcoin maxi. That conversation is generally broached with how do we integrate your existing Bitcoin stack into a full financial plan? And that's making sure that it's properly allocated, it's properly custodied, Should that be weighted? How should that be weighted in a portfolio? Is it everything you own? Should you own other assets? What type of assets are those? Personally, like my personal balance sheet is pretty odd compared to any other financial planners I know of, really. Like I own Bitcoin. I own a couple of stocks, but those stocks that I own are also Bitcoin related, and I own my business. My business, well, my business brand has become more and more correlated with Bitcoin. So not as diversified as it used to be. But in reality, like I own a business that I believe is a sellable asset, and I'm certainly building it to be a sellable asset. So my portfolio is Bitcoin and a couple of related, and then a business. That's a lot different than if you work a 9-to-5 job. Like if you work a 9-to-5, you can't sell that thing one time, like later on. That's it. That's not an asset. And unfortunately, most people who run a business, they think that, oh, I'm building this business. You've only built yourself a job. You haven't built an asset. And one day when you're ready to exit that job, you will exit that job just like you exited 9-to-5. You're not selling an asset. But if you built a good business that is a sellable asset, I would consider that maybe at some sort of discounted rate, but in some capacity, I would view that as an asset on your balance sheet. And that would thus impact as well your Bitcoin holding. Again, like if I talk to a normal person, I told them I'm 100% liquid investable assets into Bitcoin, I sound like I'm nuts. But in reality, I would say about 40% of my total investable assets or net worth is in Bitcoin. So that's a big conversation, is really how are you weighted? How should you be weighted? How do we view these other assets? If you own a business, how do we make sure that that's taken care of properly? Your age dictates these things a lot. Like over the last several months, I've brought on a lot of families who are already approaching or in retirement, and their allocation, a lot of them are allocated quite heavily. And they've come to me and said, hey, Jim, we really believe in Bitcoin. We think it's going to go up forever, but I don't want to have to go back to work when I'm 80 if something happens. So how do we build around this thing? And most Bitcoiners, even if they think that there's a small chance that something happens to Bitcoin, they still can't look away from our broken money and macro environment that we're in. So then we have to look at, well, how do we build a portfolio that is ideally uncorrelated to Bitcoin and would hedge the ultimate risks associated with Bitcoin? You know, like I don't think a 51% attack is very likely, like at all. Really, what we're talking about is like some sort of systemic macro event. And if that were to take place and really hurt Bitcoin for a prolonged period of time, especially if you're retired and you'd run into sequence of return risks, what's another asset that we should hold in order to offset those types of risks? So that's pretty big. So as you can tell, those conversations are dictated. Those are only for already Bitcoin holders. How we back into this? What's your debt situation? What's your cash flow? What's your savings rates? Like if you're super young and you have a healthy savings rate and like healthy expected future free cash flows, then I would be more comfortable with starting off with a really high Bitcoin holding. We know that, you know, if you're 26 and you have 30 grand total investable assets right now, but we know once you're 30 years old, your annual savings rate will be 100 grand a year. 30 grand is a quarter of the year's. It's one quarter's future free savings rates. And if we know like, all right, this 30 grand I'm not going to use until I'm 70. Like, all right, at that point, generally, I'm comfortable with going really, really heavily into Bitcoin, because in a couple of years, that will just be a small portion of your future free savings rate. And we're trying to make the most of the opportunity cost of this probable asymmetric rise between now and when you're 30. Because if it's like, all right, we're just going to peel apart a quarter of your savings between now and then, what if we just miss this, again, the scenario, you're 26, you miss 4 years because you're trying to be strategic between now and then, but missing out on long term. So we're trying, if again, this is really important if you're young, trying to extrapolate future situation, pull that data into the present, and then build a portfolio or in the present around a future expected portfolio. Yeah, it depends on so many things. That's for existing Bitcoiners. Then you have people, most of the people I work with came to us as not Bitcoiners at all. Like there were normal people looking for a normal financial planner and they got stuck with me. And I do this on purpose. Like I've taken flack from people on Twitter for not talking about Bitcoin on my financial planning's website. And I do that on purpose. Like if your parents or grandparents were looking for a financial planner and they went on their website, they saw like Bitcoin everywhere, there's no way they're going to interview that guy. They think he's nuts. And therefore that'd be me doing them a disservice. Like my job is not to display Bitcoin. My job is to help people with their money. And a lot of people think that Bitcoin would interfere with that rather than help. So I want to come in the back door with this thing once I've already established trust and credibility. So for most clients, I don't talk about Bitcoin at all until we've one, they've decided to hire us. And two, we've talked through their money. We've talked through their life and their values and what's important to them as a family. I've built a plan. We've talked through taxes and other things. And they see that, wow, this guy's actually not a moron. Okay. So then I bring in Bitcoin. There's some level of credibility that they'll actually listen to that conversation. And then we can start talking through what this is. And we have to anchor that in heavily of educating in Bitcoin, building conviction. And then we talk through, so anchoring very heavily, what is this? What are forms of money historically? What's stores of value historically? What is Bitcoin? How do we arrive at these things? What's a proper allocation? Setting expectations for probable drawdowns, all of this, then we can start building on that. And that's why we serve about 90 families right now. And the vast majority of them came to us not owning any Bitcoin, not knowing anything about it, or what they knew about it was frankly wrong, but we've somehow managed to orange pill every one of our families through education and trust. That was like a 10-minute ramble. I'm sorry.
No, that's great. So you, there's a few terms that you mentioned that do come up, hard assets, store of value. For that new person, you've gone through the framework of constructing a plan and doing a needs assessment. And now it's time to talk a little bit about what Bitcoin is. And it's always dangerous to try to reduce these what are probably hour-long conversations into a two-minute TLDR, but how do you frame for someone who's trying to understand Bitcoin what it is and why they would want to own it?
So I do recognize I'm in a privileged spot where people come to me specifically setting aside time to talk about money. So typically my conversations with people aren't two-minute drive-bys. They are set aside to talk about specific money topics. So I have a captive audience. So I don't try to do it in 2 minutes, frankly. So yeah, for a new client who doesn't understand Bitcoin, like I usually bring that up once someone's a client, we build a plan, we review the big macro plan, and then we start setting up these 30-minute sprint sessions to talk through specific action items on their plan. And once we're a few sprint sessions in, we'll talk through their investments. And I usually bring up Bitcoin within that investment sprint. So they come in knowing we're talking about investments. Sorry, the hiccups. But they probably think we're just going to talk through like general asset allocation, stock bond weightings, and call it a day. They didn't know that they were going to come in and learn about, what is money itself. But that's where we go. So we talk through like, hey, let's talk through allocation. Most normal advisors would talk through it in this capacity, but you should know that I'm really odd. And I let them know, like I get everything out on the table first. Like, look, 99% of financial planners think I'm wrong or, think I'm stupid for what I do. I think they're wrong. So we can disagree. I don't care if they think I'm wrong, like whatever. I think they're wrong. So I get that out there. Like, this is going to sound crazy. And I recognize that. So acknowledging that I'm going to sound nuts. Then I bring in like, but I and all of our clients own Bitcoin. So let's talk about what that is. So then I allow them to get off their chest. Like, have you heard of Bitcoin? And if so, like, what do you know about this thing? And that allows them to air any like grievance or bias. They get on the table. Because the problem is if you just start throwing facts out, even if they're fantastic things they need to hear, if they are sitting there thinking like, oh yeah, but it's used to buy drugs online. That's all I know about it or whatever. They're only going to hear themselves saying that. They're not going to hear anything you just said. So allow them to get anything off the table, acknowledge it, and either address it then or say, man, I understand. We will come to that. Let's table that for a second. That way they know they're heard. And if they're heard, they can then listen. And then, what we do is from there, we go through like, look, if you're going to understand this thing, I can't just talk about Bitcoin or it's going to sound crazy. And like, I'm trying to address a problem or I'm bringing up a solution that is no problem that's there to address. So we have to talk through what is money and stores of value. And to get there, we have to go through history. So I just prep them. We're going to go through a quick history lesson and I take them back through like, classic Bitcoiner stuff, like history, stores of value and monies and coinage and all these fun things and World War I and the confiscation of gold in the US and Bretton Woods and 1971. And then I bring in like, okay, then we sort of leave money itself. I sort of allude to the petrodollar. I don't try to get in the weeds on too much of this stuff here, but like I allude to the petrodollar to show like it's still crazy. It's not just crazy back for Rome. It's crazy here now. And then once you've gone through these things, then I switch over more to a Bitcoin conversation because that's all money and stores of value. Now I have to bridge this gap somehow. So then we acknowledge, like, look, Bitcoin is not this thing that some dude invented in his basement 10 years ago for kids to buy Lambos. Like, no, this is something that people who are way smarter than you and me have been trying to address since the 70s. If we could have some sort of money that's digital to a computer, how could we create that? That could be sent from one person to another. And that's something people started thinking about in the 70s and really sort of working more through in the 80s and really working through in the 90s. But they kept running through these issues. And I tell them about these problems of double spin and decentralized ledger and how crazy smart people kept running into this stuff. And then finally, a guy in 2008 came up with the solutions and created this paper and sent it out. And he cited all of his sources. So it's like, look, this is a legitimate thing. He cited his sources, sent it out, explaining the code and how and why it works. And then it went out, and here's what it is. At this point, they realized, wow, money is something that I've never even thought, what is it? And now I understand how it works and why certain monies make sense and why certain monies definitely don't make sense and how Bitcoin fits into this thing. And we've tied in throughout this conversation the issues of being able to create new units of money and portability of money and all these things with Bitcoin. So once we're there, it's like, oh yeah, like this makes total sense. Now, I should own some. Like, how much? What do you usually own? What do you think? And then we go into their situation and we carry on from there.
I would imagine like one of the challenges when people are planning for the distant future with their finances, they are seeking some sense of security, which maybe can be a troubling thing for forecasting Bitcoin because it is a very young asset in terms of the things that it might be compared to instead. And this is like, you know, there's not much you can do about how old Bitcoin is. It's just as old as it is. But how do you sort of tackle like helping people think about a 30-year plan for something that's only 15 years old?
Okay, yeah, a few things with that. One, helping them recognize what they thought was stable is actually outrageously unstable is super important. Because I'm not trying to juxtapose this amazing button-clad or ironclad position with like US treasuries and like traditional finance versus this crazy thing that exists. I'm trying to make them realize everything that you thought was secure is absolutely not. Like our money is a fraud and this is what money is. So it's a paradigm shift. Like, you know, anyone who really understands Bitcoin no longer views Bitcoin as the numerator and it's like, it just goes up and versus these things. There's this total script that's flipped of like, oh wait, it's the denominator. And you can't get there until you've reframed how our money works. So we have to anchor so deep of paradigm shifting, like, wait a second. So at that point, they start realizing the stability of these long-term assets isn't what they thought it was. And then they're okay. Like, we can plant on a new soil. And this new soil is real money and real stores of value versus, again, juxtaposing this and that. It's building from the ground up on fresh, good soil. Now, yes, to address your question, but in reality, like it all sounds good, but how do we build a financial plan considering this asset that has a very short track record and what ifs? There's a lot of ways to approach that. One, again, just anchoring in education. What is money? What is Bitcoin? Also, I mean, very simply talking through different types of risks. I mean, everything, any investment has several risks. Anything you do in life is risky. There's always opportunity cost. You have to assess what those risks are. You know, like there's people, I forgot what the disorder is called. People who are crazy and like they won't leave their house, you know, and they think that anything, if they go outside, they're going to get a disease or get hit by a bus or whatever. So they feel like the safest thing they can do is just be a shut in at their house. And to them, in their head, that's safe. The problem is they are subjecting themselves to massive risks. You know, they're going to get like crazy psychological things for not interacting with people and like probably massively vitamin D deficient and whatever else, you know, like that's risky. They just don't think, they don't perceive that risk. So one is helping people address the certain risks. And also like, all right, if there are risks in different capacities and categories, how do we address these different types? And that all comes through allocation, weighting, and considering like sequence of returns and again, like future free cash flows, these types of things come into building a proper portfolio. Also viewing Bitcoin, like something that's always interesting is talking through, if you're trying to get someone over the hump of like going from zero to like 3%, and our average client owns significant amount of total allocation of Bitcoin. But if you're trying to get someone like 3%, I ran the numbers recently. I wrote an article on this, I don't know, 3 weeks ago, maybe, of valuing Bitcoin. And talking through if this narrative happens that I just described, what would happen to your other assets? And owning, like, I forgot the numbers it came to, it was like 3 or 4% of your portfolio would actually just allow you to sustain your current total real value of assets. Because in reality, if Bitcoin goes up, not in nominal terms, but in real terms, that has to come to the detriment of other assets that are monetized, you know? So if those assets go down in real value, so the price of Bitcoin go up in real value, you need to own some Bitcoin in order just to hedge that devaluation. And in my calculations, that comes to about a 4% allocation of your portfolio to Bitcoin just to retain existing total purchasing power. Anything above that, in theory, would increase your purchasing power. So just talking through that, and that's, okay, well, we're trying to retain based off of this, you know, math that I did, that sounds squirrely, how much we need to grow and what would growth be and how much my comfortable was doing there. Does that make sense? You ask like one question, we're going to do like four questions this whole conversation.
It's great. I think it's so natural and common for what I sort of consider to be a miscategorization of risk when it comes to Bitcoin. What people often sort of think of is probably the potential of the risk of a significant drawdown versus the risk of Bitcoin somehow just having some kind of technical failure and not working anymore. And it's often like belied by this weird, you know, I feel like most people want to believe on the inside that money will work over the next 30 years the way it's worked the last 50. And it, obviously it's different everywhere you live, depending on what country you're in, to different degrees. But the mathematics behind money has changed dramatically over the last 50 years. And the likelihood that just money itself will perform the way it has, the way that we're used to it performing in our lives is probably pretty low. And that thing on its own is very bullish for Bitcoin. And I think that's in my own experience, a difficult thing for people to want to wrap their heads around.
Yeah, it's skins because most people have not stopped to ask, what is money? And that's where I talk to financial planners all the time. These financial planners, a lot of them are like super smart. You know, like they're really great at helping people with their money and managing things around money, like tax planning and maybe like equity compensation, things like that. But again, they work with money and they're good with topics surrounding it, but they haven't stopped to ask, but what is money itself? And until you address that base question, and it sounds so simple, but until you address that, anything past that's going to sound so foolish. And that would be like a fish that lives really close to shore and it just stays in this area and it swims around and like it feels like it's doing great. Maybe it's a great fish and it's surviving and thriving well in its environment. But you zoom out and in reality, that water it's in, it's right next to like a toxic waste dump and all this polluted water is dumping in, or this pollution is dumping in this water. And it's actually been swimming around in sludge and it doesn't know that it's in this toxic environment because it hasn't stopped to ask like, wait a second, what's water? This thing that we've been calling water is actually like 60% whatever, like brake fluid. And I need to escape this contaminated area and go out to actual water. But if you're a fish and you ask like other fish, like what's water? It's like, what do you mean? What is water? We're in it all the time. You sound stupid. So a lot of people don't want to ask those questions, especially once you're like credentialed and, oh, I work with money and I do these things. Like if you ask these silly, simple questions, you're going to be viewed as maybe too elementary, or if you're built up and you have to break things down, that can be a hit to your ego. That's why the further out you go on these things, it's harder to turn back around because you have so much to lose in that sense. Or perceive so much to lose. In reality, you're losing it anyways.
Another sort of misnomer that I think comes up a lot is the description of Bitcoin as a speculative asset, which I just find hilarious because all assets are speculative. But it's this idea that you might want to own some Bitcoin. It might go up, you know, and like this is kind of the non-Bitcoiner financial advice paradigm is like, yeah, you the reason for owning some might be just because were it to go up, you wouldn't want to miss out. And that completely ignores the functionality of what Bitcoin is actually offering. And I think that might be a good segue into just talk a little bit about this concept of like, how do you, how would you best describe the properties of having like money that can't be the denominator money?
Something else that we go through with these conversations is addressing that like speculative asset and risky. and addressing the fact that risk and volatility are not the same thing. And that's where a lot of people get this wrong as well. They view Bitcoin as risky because they see a lot of price movement, but they've wrongly defined risk. Risk and volatility are not synonymous. They become more and more correlated as time frames get compressed. That's where, again, sequence of return risks. So if you put all of your emergency fund, so you need to go buy a car this week. So last week you needed 60 grand for it. So you bought one Bitcoin and last week for a car you need to buy this week. That's super risky. And it turns out that was a really bad idea because sequence of return, because that money at the time that it drew down was really bad. It coincided with when you need it. But that's because your time frame is so small. If we zoom out and you needed to buy, 60 grand car, so you put 60 grand into Bitcoin 10 years ago, obviously that worked out a lot better. And was that risky? Again, depending on how we define these things, you certainly experienced volatility along the way, but it was subjecting yourself to a different type of risks. So addressing these factors. So you can go buy, treasuries and have experienced basically zero volatility. So it feels safe in that capacity. But if you're sitting on, well, let's say you put the money under your mattress, I just feel safe. And I've talked to crazy people who are like, look, I literally put money under my mattress because that is what grandma did. And man, I feel comfortable doing that. And they feel safe by doing that, not recognizing that their perception of safety was actually subjecting themselves to outrageous risk, like a guaranteed, we'll call it 5% devaluation annually. So that was a comforting way of guaranteed loss. That's like if you're going to go down to a lake and just lower yourself in the water, like you can just lower yourself real slowly and it's, this is nice. It's calm and comfortable. And before you know it, you're fully underwater and you drown. It was a smooth transition. It was risky. You were guaranteed to die. But hey, it wasn't volatile at least. And that's what a lot of people do with their money is they experience comfort to their grave and they just lost their total portfolio. So reframing what is risk and what is volatility allows people to start connecting these dots. That is not what you asked, though. Sorry, could you give me the question again?
It's a great question. I would have to actually rewind I think it was, it's like, how can you best describe for a client the purpose of owning money that just cannot be diluted?
That's right. And then also like the positioning as the denominator rather than the numerator. Again, that I feel like I know it sounds like I'm repeating myself, and it's because we anchor so heavily in the basics that once you've got those down, all these peripheral things sort of light up. So if we can start addressing the fact that what you perceive as being a safe asset and the bedrock of a financial plan of US dollars and maybe like an index fund, once you start addressing like money that we have, and you start addressing like these, the monetization of other assets and started like addressing these things, then you realize that there's risks that they did not perceive with a traditional portfolio. And then that allows you to start seeing like, sort of a hedge to that risk is by owning this asset. And this asset in a sense is not speculative. Owning only those things is speculative because you're speculating that the status quo will continue into perpetuity versus an actual healthy rebalance into a natural environment. That's like Southern California. It's like something people want to trick themselves and think that Southern California is Hawaii. It's not. It's a desert that backs into the ocean. And yet it surprises everyone every year when there's like big old fires. Like, oh, how could it happen? Like, dude, you live in a flipping desert. Like you planted those palm trees there. Those aren't natural, man. And when we have like forest fires should happen. They're a really healthy thing. They're good for the environment. It's good for the soil. It's good for future growth. Like they need to happen. The problem is we've built these fake environments to host things that we feel comfortable with. And suddenly we perceive Malibu as being safe because we have this false perception of the environment that we've built around us. In reality, the underpinnings of that climate, it's not what you think it is. We just glossed it over with, Dior shops and, nice things. But when reality sets in and a forest fire takes place and it burns it down, that allows for healthy nutrients to re-enter the ground and for regrowth to take place. And that's really what needs to happen with our monetary situation. We've built this ecosystem that has this perception of plenty and we're doing well. But the moment you look underneath it, you realize like, no, this is like super bad, built on top of this thing that's not, it's not what you think it is. And the only way for this to actually get back to a healthy environment is not going to be through a new president or a couple of new tax reforms or whatever. The whole thing has to get burned down and rebuilt for new seeds to come into fresh soil.
That's a great analogy. Yeah, absolutely. No,
my brain works in bad analogies.
You know, I wonder about like, it's this sort of systemic confusion around inflation. I see this even, financial professionals fall victim to this all the time. It's like the fish hook with the bait is the headline that inflation is coming down. And that even for people who understand money really well, somehow they translate that message in their head into prices are coming down, or, you know, when really it's the rate at which prices are going up is coming down. And there just is this massive cognitive dissonance around what inflation is, how it works. And maybe it's some idea that like at time, and I get it, it's nonlinear, and at different times it's less bad, but it's just the weirdest thing.
Yeah, less bad implies that it's still bad. It's just less of bad. Yeah, and we've been brainwashed into thinking that this less bad situation of slight regular inflation is good. Like when I was in college, in my different economics classes, economics made no sense to me. Like I could not, and I'm not stupid. And I'm pretty good with numbers, and I think very logically, and I love going back to like base questions. And that's where like economics made no sense, because I cannot address the simple questions to then build, you know, throughout a semester of an economics class, you build these theories on top of another. I never got to the base situation of like, but how does this basically work? And there's no foundation that actually explains it when you're trying to approach this from a Keynesian view. And I felt like I was a moron in college. Like, how are all these other people understanding this? I just can't get it. And it's because it's really doesn't make any sense. So that's where a lot of people, I think they stumble through thinking like, well, I guess that's, you know, this is how money works. And it's supposed to continue to expand, and things are supposed to go slowly get more expensive because that helps our job economy, like somehow, or our job market somehow. Like, I don't know. It just does, because some smart guy said it does. And that guy won a Nobel Prize. He must know what he's talking about. Like, no, it's absolutely nuts. Yeah, the misperceptions. Like, man, I hate this term. Like, I'm a millennial. The term, I think, is called gaslighting. I might be misusing that. That's what all the kids on social media say. I think gaslighting is that when you say something that's like you're putting someone else at like positioning as it's their fault when it's not really. Is that what gaslighting is?
That could be one way to describe it. Or I think it's also just, yeah, convincing somebody that something that isn't true is true.
Okay. So I've worked with like 45,000 people, I would guess, with their money. And on average, what I've experienced is people spend about 35% more than they think they do. And that historically, and I'm curious, I want to rerun the sample post 2020 numbers. That's pre-2020. It's about 35% more than they think they spend. Now it's a lot more than that. So most people do succumb to lifestyle creep and they just spend more money. And usually it's like food and stuff. The thing is, that's not accounting for this expanded money supply and inflation. That's why I talk to people all the time who are like, man, I'm just like, I had a meeting last night. Wow, we're spending way more on this than we thought we did. And, you know, all the time. And that's where gaslighting comes in, is I see this like other financial planners will post on Twitter and stuff talking about like, oh, you just need to like, you need to go earn more money and stop spending and like cut out this thing. And it's like, I get that. Like most people do spend more on stupid things than they should. And a lot of people are using money for things that they would say aren't even valuable for them and they could cut out. But at the same time, there is some extent of gaslighting going on by the traditional finance mouths to tell people like, look, this is all your fault. And if you stop buying lattes, you'd be in a better situation. Completely dismissing the fact that like we've expanded the monetary supply by 40% over the last couple of years. Of course, things just cost more. And dude, like there's no way that old lady's pension went up by 40%. Doesn't have a cost of living. So I'm getting mad at her acting like she's being irresponsible. The people being irresponsible are the people expanding our money supply. Blame them. Don't blame her. That drives me crazy. And that's where most people fail to recognize this problem. They address it at the surface level with an individual person. There is a place of accountability and personal accountability, but we are glossing it over, especially you see this a lot, like Gen Z, I think it's Gen Z with the young kids. Like there is a place of like, dude, do it, make it work. My wife, her name's Kendra. This is Kendra behind me. So Kendra she and I, when we got married in 2012, I always romanticized being a poor newlywed. And we were super poor. Like 2013, I'm pretty sure like our gross income was about 13 grand. Like we go to the grocery store and I was like, oh, there's no meat that's getting thrown out because it's too old. Like, I guess we can't eat meat this week. Like that was us. And I loved it. It was so fun. I feel like some people nowadays, it's like, oh, well, woe is me because I can't, you know, go to Greece for the week. You know, like, oh, I want to do these things. There's a lot of keeping up with the Joneses that's made worse through social media. You're not keeping up with the Joneses across the street. You're keeping up with the Joneses across the world. And you have this more magnified view of what normal is. Anyways, there's this weird place that's happening right now, especially with Gen Z, but in general, of like part of you feel stressed because you're doing these things that are unnecessary and stupid and really not important to you. You've tricked yourself into thinking it is. But also, there is this extent of like, again, like this gaslighting that's happening. You know, you keep seeing these goofy TikTok videos of people whining in their car after a job, like, oh, I feel poor and I hate my life. And part of that's because like a lot of things, but part of it is because like you are poor. You're getting poorer every day. And it's a mixed bag. And money is a communication vector. It should communicate value across space and time. But our money's messed up. Therefore, the communication's messed up. Therefore, we're getting mixed signals. It's hard to understand how much of this is me and my misappropriation of funds, and how much is the money that is miscommunicating, and that's hard to address with people, and that messes up budgets and accountability. You have old people yelling at young people that if you just stop spending so much, I hear this all the time. Like, oh well, my first house was a 15% mortgage. Yeah, but you're addressing just the interest rate, not total affordability. Like, dude, you bought your house for like 15 grand. And yeah, you had a 15% interest rate, but it still is like 14% of your total gross income. These kids, it's 45%, even though they're only at a 7% interest rate. And so it's messing up communication. It's making people mad. Yeah. So bad. So many ways.
Yeah. And there's, on top of that, again, kind of outright lying about different metrics of reporting. One of my favorites to pick on is CPI and, you know, the CPI, whatever, get it down to 3%. It's this, that. There was a viral video I saw from a week or two ago of a guy who had used the reorder function on the Walmart app to purchase again an order that he had originally made, I think in 2020, that was $126. It was like 50 items, whatever. And that exact same order was $440. So like inflation, they say, was ever 7-10%. Well, that's 300% in my math, or however the, you know, and like, so there is just, of course, people can't make sense of it. And of course, it's frustrating. I think you made a ton of great points there. So I'm always, you know, trying to convey this message around like, Bitcoin might seem weird, but it is actually a much simpler basis for a monetary system that is sensical compared to the base layer of complexity of measuring stuff in a unit of measurement that's constantly fluctuating, and then building on top of that foundation of sand, like all this additional complexity. Like it's gotten crazy.
Yeah, Bitcoin seems weird because the concept of a hard money is foreign, and the concept of self-sovereignty and an owner bear, like a bearer asset, is foreign. In reality, like I can explain to someone what Bitcoin is and why it's important within an hour, and they understand it and adopt it. There's no chance I'm explaining how the fiat monetary system works in an hour. Like I can't do that. Like it would take me hours to try to get you understand like what are central banks? What's a Federal Reserve? Like how's new money created? In all different ways. Like, is it printed? Is it created because lending at banks? Like the implications of all these things, the trickle effect of a bank making a loan off of a non-collateralized asset. Like I can't explain that. I can hardly understand it. There's no way I'm going to explain that to all these people and they adopt it. There's also a place of one. I genuinely believe that Bitcoin is easier to understand than our money system. Because I can understand Bitcoin, I can't understand our money. And I've talked to a lot of people. Like understanding this is way easier. Two, you don't really have to understand things in order to use it. Like I have zero clue how I can see you and hear you right now. And like I don't know where you're at. You're like you're far away from me. I don't know how this works. I still use it. I don't know how most things work. I just need to know that it does, and it's probably pretty good, like good enough for me. If I were to need to understand everything before I use it, like I was going to say, I'd probably just sit at home on a chair and like make a fire because I don't know how the stove works. But in reality, like I don't know how you know, fire is created in the molecular, like, combustion of fire. Like, I'm pretty stupid. Yeah. I think people are recognize, like, let's start there. Like, you're not as smart as you think you are, dude. Like, let's get, that's, I think a lot of people, ego gets in the way of adopting things so often because you have to protect and act like you understand more. Like, recognize, like, I know very little. I know very little about very few things. And I can admit that. Now let's keep going. Until you can admit that, you're not going to be able to adopt new things or be comfortable with growing because you're protecting the ego rather than going after growing. Yeah. So much simpler. And if we could, it's only simple. One thing I run across is with people trying to help their friends buy Bitcoin is they'll jump right into like talking about the hash rate and all that. It's like, dude, that's not necessary right now. Don't go there. You're going to confuse them and think that you're crazy. You have to start with the basics and build on a foundation. And if you're trying, again, if you go to like straight to hash rate or something like that, you're trying to build on this new system versus recognizing that the existing system is not what they think it is and then building off of that. You can't build this parallel thing and all of a sudden you're juxtaposing. You've got to build it up from the fresh. So yeah, you can just have enough time to have those conversations. That's the hard part.
But to pick your brain a little bit around custody. So as you're helping people figure out how to safely store their Bitcoin, can we just talk a little bit about maybe some of your, how you approach that subject and some, maybe some basic things that you might recommend for people who are, feeling uneasy about this idea of being the custodian of their own bearer asset?
Yeah, so we go through that after we've talked through like, what is it? Portfolio allocation, they've bought Bitcoin, they're getting really comfortable with this thing. Now it's less of a, it's less foreign. So they're starting to understand not just Bitcoin as this thing that should go up, but it is, okay, I understand what money is now. And because of that, they start being more comfortable with the concept of custodying it. We talked through, there's different ways of getting exposure to Bitcoin. We talked through all that capacity through like peripheral, be it through an ETF or even further peripheral through owning a company that owns Bitcoin, like MicroStrategy or owning miners. Like those are peripheral means of exposure, quasi exposure to the price movement of Bitcoin, but it's not Bitcoin. Talking through like that, like this is not Bitcoin. These are things that move in tandem with the price of Bitcoin in theory or somewhat correlated to it. And then we go into owning Bitcoin directly, but keeping on exchange and then owning Bitcoin. And we talk through like hot wallet. We talk through Bitcoin and putting on a hardware wallet or keeping on exchange or a hardware wallet or multi-sig and this different levels of having exposure to the price, but also taking custody and the different risks associated with it. Yeah, that's generally we're going to get them off an exchange onto self-custodied. Yeah, be it a single sig or multi-sig setup. This goes in with inheritance protocols, estate planning, gifting, all kinds of stuff there. But yeah, it's so much of just education and allowing them to ask questions and expose them to everything that is available. You're not just saying you have to do this route because they're going to think, well, what else is there? I heard there's an ETF I can just buy. Like, why should I not do that? Just address it all. Like so much of what I do is actually having people present questions. And then I get anything that should go along with the question. And I put it on the table and say, here's everything else that goes into a decision. Here's things you didn't consider. Let's talk through all of these things. That way they make a decision in full light of all the facts, not just specifics. Again, like what's going to happen is if you don't address other things that could come up in a particular topic, they're going to leave, talk to someone else. And it's like, oh, wait, this whole time I could have bought an ETF. I'm just going to go do that. And if they don't know the difference between the ETF and self-custodied, then they're making an uninformed decision. Maybe they should buy an ETF and not Bitcoin directly. Maybe they shouldn't. But they don't know that in light of their circumstance if you not address that in their conversation. Otherwise, that can lead to distrust. Same thing goes with like, if we're talking through, hey, you should do a Roth conversion or you should not do a Roth IRA or whatever, like anything. You should own Bitcoin. You know, if I tell a client they should own Bitcoin and I just leave it at that, they're going to go talk to like their neighbor or their friends and be like, dude, you got to fire that guy. He's a moron. But if I educate them on why they should buy it and what it is, they will then educate their neighbor or friend and orange for them. So we go through that with everything. It's like, I tried to address the things that will come up later on. So they're further educated. I'm not just trying to, don't follow me blindly. That'd be stupid.
Maybe as a final thought, for somebody who's looking to educate themselves before they reach out to somebody like yourself, do you have a favorite book or resource that you like to point people to?
Favorite things. So I guess book-wise, I would say Bitcoin Standard. I don't refer people there a ton. I'll use that as a secondary resource, but I don't want to like, hey, you should listen to this, or, you know, here's Bitcoin. Go read this book for the next month. Typically, like Breedlove's conversation with Preston, episode one, Bitcoin Common Misconceptions. That's a really good one. Parker Lewis did a talk last fall. Bitcoin is not a hedge. Really good. I have a conversation on YouTube with a guy. We talked through, his name's Michael Schmid. Michael Schmid's really big in like home mining. We talked through what is Bitcoin on a technical side. I think it's the best conversation I've heard of helping simpletons like me understand like what is Bitcoin, not money, but like the actual Bitcoin. Like what is code? What do we even mean by code? And like, what's hash rate? Like, we have a conversation there. I think it's fantastic. And then, yeah, Bitcoin Standard. There's so many good resources out there. I think a lot of it goes with personality. Like, personally, the way that Saylor explains things, I think he sounds sort of loony. I know it's going to take a lot of heat flat for saying that. But I think a lot of his stuff is, it will make people think you're crazy. They hear you talking about, like, cyber hornets. Like, what are you talking about, dude? You're making things up at this point. That might scare some normal people off. So don't introduce them. Other people, like, I have my brother-in-law, like, he understood Bitcoin really through Saylor, because he thinks the same way. So you have to sort of go off personality too.
So for anybody who's listening and wants to find more of you, we'll include some links in the show notes, but anywhere specific you'd like to point people to?
Yeah, if you want to chat, would love to. My website, it's intentionallivingfp.com. On there, there's a link to my calendar. Throw a time on my calendar if you want to chat. Even if it's just like, look, I don't want to hire you. I just have a question about these two things. Like, more than happy to answer those questions the best I can.
Jim, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks so much for coming on the show and sharing your perspectives and ideas.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. Appreciate. Sorry I talked your ear off, but it was fun.
No, this is great. And if you're listening and you made it all the way to the end of the show, I want to thank you for tuning in as well and hope to see you again next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. Block Rewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits. Supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Special thanks to our top sponsor, Paramount Employee Benefits Consulting, Canada's only Bitcoin-forward benefits and pension advisory. For more information, find them at paramountbenefits.ca. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and BMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.